All right. Tuesday night Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're going to get started in chapter 8 today, hopefully do about half of it. Somebody asked me recently, am I planning on getting through all of the Gospel of John this year? And I'm still moving faster than Pastor Q does. That I can tell you, for any of you who have attended his Bible studies. But no, given that it's 21 chapters, I'm not sure, and we're only in chapter 8. We probably won't finish this year. We'll take a break in the spring, probably around Memorial Day, and then probably have to finish it up in the fall, after the summer break. So, but that's okay. This is a good Bible study. I'm enjoying learning about it in order to teach. Hopefully you guys are learning lots of things too, and I know you are. So, last time we talked, we were in chapter 7. Finishing up chapter 7, all of chapter 7 is Jesus at the Feast of Booths. And if you remember, at first he said, no, I'm not going. Then he kind of secretly went down. And then in the middle of the feast, he started teaching and preaching, kind of in the temple courts. And then people started to challenge him. How can he have authority like this? They sent the temple guard to arrest him. And the temple guard was so enamored by the profoundness of Jesus teaching and preaching, they came back and where is it? Let's find it here. The officer, there it is, verse 45, near the end of chapter 7. They came to the chief priests and Pharisees, who said to them, "Why did you not bring him?" And the officers answered, "No one ever spoke like this man." "Have you also been deceived?" they say. So, again, a lot of question about who Jesus is. Remember the overall theme. And Jesus is teaching a number of things while here on the Temple Mount during the Feast of Tabernacles. And right there near the end of chapter 7 where we finished, Nicodemus said to them, he spoke up, he was a Pharisee, he was a member of the Sanhedrin. He says, we can't judge him without first hearing what he has to say, learning what he's talking about. So there is the second of three times we hear about Nicodemus, and Nicodemus works up some courage there to try and kind of defend Jesus a little bit, which I think took a lot of courage, because then they turn and argue with him. "Are you from Galilee? No prophet comes from there." So that was an insult to Nicodemus. "Are you from Galilee?" That's like, "Are you from that backwater area? Nobody important is from there." What would the equivalent of that be around here? Baroda? "Are you from Baroda?" somebody would say, huh? So that would kind of be an insult. So I should never say that, right?
Baroda Heights.
That's a little better. That's the suburbs of Baroda?
And the traffic of Baroda is horrendous.
You might have to actually stop at a stop sign because somebody's coming the other way. Yeah, right. All right. All sound familiar? So Jesus is here at the on the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. One of the things that he says up here, which I didn't bring out, but whoever believes in me, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. One of the themes, one of the primary events or rituals in the Feast of Booths was water. So Jesus is connecting himself with that. Is Jesus the replacement or the fulfillment of Passover? Yes. That's the first great Jewish feast. Is Jesus the replacement or the fulfillment of the Feast of Weeks or the Feast of Pentecost? Yes. And now here, Jesus is also pointing himself to the fulfillment of the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. All right. Then we have this little section. It's one verse in chapter 7. Why they did that, I don't know. Chapter 7, verse 53, they went each to his own house. And then it continues on for 11 verses in chapter 8, so I'll go there. It says right here in the ESV, the earliest manuscripts do not include these verses. So, and they're included in some manuscripts in other locations, like in Luke or somewhere else in the Gospel of John. So first of all, let me forward the text here on the screen to chapter 8. Why is this in question? And is it authentic? So let me address that first of all. I read a fair amount of what Dr. Weinrich had to say in his commentary. The earliest manuscripts, and there's at least 8 of them, that can be dated to the 2nd and 3rd century do not include this. This text does not appear until the earliest at the 4th century, so 400 years after the time of Christ. And multiple manuscripts that had been written down, scrolls, did not include this. That speaks pretty loudly. Because if this was original and this was part of what John said, then you would think it would go all the way back to the earliest manuscripts. It would have been included. Further, Dr. Weinrich makes the point that none of the early church fathers in the first 3 centuries even mentioned this event at all. They don't talk about what's happening here. Again, that leads to the idea that it wasn't part of the original text of the Gospel of John. Okay? However, after the 4th century, it was included in texts, but in different locations. Again, that's suspicious right there. Why is it in different locations? If it had been just left out of the Gospel of John, you would think it would always appear in the same spot. But it's located in different places in John, and sometimes it's in Luke. Again, doesn't seem to be authentic. Dr. Weinrich proposes this as a conclusion, and after reading his article on it, it kind of sold me on it, that this is not original to the Apostle John. John did not write this section, this event right here. However, he suspects or surmises that possibly this event is a real event that Jesus was involved in that was carried down as oral tradition for 4 centuries. And you remember back in the ancient world, they had much greater memories than us. And parents would tell their children and then tell their grandchildren the family lore. You know, the family history, and the my grandfather came from Idaho and settled down there in Montana, or whatever. You know, and so they would carry on those family stories and family traditions, and people could remember those. That's how it was done. Half the world was illiterate anyway, so they couldn't write. And the other half that could read and write, it was very expensive to get sheepskins or parchment and write things down. So oral tradition was a good thing, or a known thing, and very strong memories they had back then. Unlike us today, right? Andy, right? Yeah. My kids will tell you, especially Carissa, she brings it up every time that I call her, and so does Isaac, that I call them by the wrong name. And she said, "Why do you even call me Isaac or Elliot? I'm a girl. They're boys." I don't know, they're just, the names are popping in my head, and eventually I rattle off all 4 till I get to the right one. You guys ever done that before? Yeah. Kids, grandkids, whatever. I'm at a stage of life where I'm doing that. But they had good memories back then, and so Dr. Weinrich suspects this was probably a real event that Jesus was involved in, and it was carried on in oral tradition among Christians, among the followers of Christ, until the point somewhere in the 4th century, somebody said, you know what, we better write this down before we lose track of it. And so it got written down, and then some scribes, as they were making further copies of the Bible, they started to insert it in various places, but different places, because it wasn't original. That seems plausible. Okay? To me, that seems like a plausible idea that, you know, this is preserved for us now after 1600 years. It's in the Bible, although it's footnoted in pretty much any translation you read. It'll say this was not part of the earliest manuscripts. So it's probably not, I do think, it's probably not written by the Apostle John, but it is probably telling us about a real event that Jesus was involved in. Does that make sense? Okay.
So what decides if it stays or doesn't? Because I can Mark, you know, that part of Mark, they have the same thing.
Yes, there's actually a handful of spots in the whole Bible that this happens.
Right, because like in 1 John in chapter 5, there's a verse where it talks about the three being the three Trinity in that, but they don't have that. I can, this my version won't be in there, but in the King James version it is, but there's not even a footnote about it. So I was just curious, like, what decides what actually stays and what doesn't? I mean, how do they decide that?
Scholarly agreement.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. And so, for instance, in the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament, Nestle and Aland were the two Greek scholars who started collecting the Greek manuscripts. They're on the 27th edition, actually. By now, I think it's the 28th. About every few years, they come out with another edition, because they'll find some scrap of a text in some ancient library, and then they'll adjust it and amend it, and the scholars kind of have to generally agree that, yes, this is part of the text. And so most of the Bible, 95%, 98% of the Bible, is the same in all the earliest manuscripts. There are manuscripts, texts, sheepskins, parchments that go back to the second century or so. So the first six or eight different sets of copies that date over that 200-year span, fairly early, are all the same in 95%. So everyone agrees that this 95% of the Bible, which is most of what we have, is authentic, is written by who we think it was, and it's their actual words that they recorded, inspired by the Holy Spirit. But then there's a few anomalies between some of those manuscripts, a handful of them. And so our modern, more modern translations, especially the ESV, notes those. So that's why you have the spot in Mark, you have this spot here, there's a couple other spots, there's one or two in the Old Testament, where it's like, the manuscripts differ, this is in one but not in another, so we're not sure if it's authentic or not, so there's some question about it. And of course, you probably heard Pastor Q say, or me say, all of those places in question, it's a half a dozen or so, you could just take them right out of the Bible and it doesn't affect anything that we know or believe. So they're kind of irrelevant. Other than that, they might add a little bit of detail to the life of Jesus, like this story right here. So let's get into this story. Is it original to the Gospel of John? Probably not. Is it a real event that Jesus actually encountered and experienced? Probably yes, but I say probably in both cases, because we don't know. All right. You've heard this story, though. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. So first of all, Mount of Olives, that's across the Kidron Valley. That's where he was staying, over in Bethany by Mary and Martha with them. That's generally where he would stay. And then he comes back to the temple. That's where everything took place during these feasts. All the activity was there at the temple. So he comes back to the temple, and all the people came to him. Now they recognized him. He's been teaching openly, right? And he sat down and taught them. That is the posture of teaching back then. Quite the opposite of us right now. The teacher would sit, and all the students would stand around them, listening, probably jockeying for position, or I can't quite hear, so you push your way towards the front. You know, if you've ever been on a tour, maybe, or something like that. Unlike us, where I kind of stand up and pace a little bit, and you guys are all seated, so quite the opposite. But it was their habit then. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" So here they are, and it's pretty obvious, even at this point of reading about this event, they're setting up Jesus, aren't they? They're trying to trap him. He's known to be compassionate. He helps everyone who needs help. So if he says, no, don't stone her, then he's breaking the law of Moses. If he says, yes, do stone her, then that's damaging his reputation as a compassionate rabbi, and the crowds will start to turn on him. Okay? Does that make sense? So they're putting Jesus in a pickle here. Did they have pickles back then? I think they probably did. They had vinegar. So how would you preserve vegetables for long term? They didn't have refrigeration. So if you wanted to preserve vegetables for the long term, you'd have to pickle them, right? Who likes pickled beets? Well, a few of you. No? Aw, oh, Phil. My son Isaac and I love pickled beets. But, you know, what we call pickles are actually pickled cucumbers, right? Anyway, sorry.
Well, the other part of that is, if it was an act of adultery, the man and the woman were supposed both supposed to come.
Yes. And so there is another sign that they're trying to trap Jesus. Because, strictly according to the law of Moses, both the man and the woman engaged in the adultery were both supposed to be stoned. However, the crowd is going to have more compassion for the woman. Because most likely, in most cases, it's the man who's driving the adultery. So they leave the man out of this on purpose to put even more pressure on Jesus to either show compassion, which he's known to do, or to uphold the law of Moses. And in either case, he's stuck. Right? It's a trap. And you're right. Where's the man that was involved in this? Yeah, that's missing. Shows you it's a trap. Okay? All right. Not always the man that kind of leads the adultery. Sometimes it's the women too. So, but you know, we all know realities of things. Okay. All right. So, what do you say? What say you? As some commentators will say. All right. Verse 6. This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." So you've heard this before. This is Jesus writing on the ground with his finger. Nobody knows what he would have written. Now the speculation is that a judge, they're coming to Jesus as the judge. "Okay, Jesus, here's this woman caught in adultery. You pronounce judgment. What is it?" That back at that time, this sort of makes sense. Back at that time, if somebody was acting as a judge in a legal matter or a dispute between people, they would first write down their verdict before proclaiming the verdict so that it's written for record-keeping purposes. Well, that makes sense. I think we probably do that today, too, don't we? I don't know. If a judge is written down, or the jury writes down a verdict before it's proclaimed, but certainly the court stenographer is there recording everything. So, was Jesus writing with his finger on what his verdict was, and so they could read it as he's about to pronounce it? Possibly. We don't know. Another speculation is that he was just plain ignoring them. He knew it was a trap. So he wasn't going to give them an answer. So he's just writing with his finger, something completely unrelated. Anyway, they pressed him as they continued to ask him. He stood up and said to them, so they continue to press him. He's not going to get out of it. He's trying to avoid it or forestall. "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." Now that's a pretty wise response. Because what does Jesus say elsewhere in the Sermon on the Mount? "First take the plank out of your own eye before you take the speck out of someone else's eye." Remember that? He's basically saying, you who have committed the same sin, you can't judge that other person. You've got a plank in your eye and you're trying to judge the person who has a speck in their eye. So first you have to get rid of the sin in your own life before you have any authority to pass judgment on someone else. So, on the one hand, he's saying, who here is sinless that would have the authority to pronounce judgment on her? In a more specific sense, this also has the meaning, who here is without lustful sin that can pronounce judgment upon this adultery? And the reason that is also in view here, a double meaning, is because in order to accuse this woman, and technically the man who's absent, you had to actually catch them in the act. You needed two witnesses to see the act. And one of the commentators I read said, "What man would not walk upon such a scene and have some lustful thoughts pop into his own head?" I don't know about women, but For men, that could be the case. So Jesus is kind of saying here, you happened upon this. No doubt there are wrongful thoughts going through your head having seen this event, witnessing it. Because otherwise, if you didn't witness it, you don't have the right to accuse. So in either case, whether it's the greater, let him who without sin, who doesn't have any sin whatsoever, who is pure and holy, or him who without sexual sin or lustful thoughts, in either case it applies. The statement applies. And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. Again, what did he write? We don't know. And when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. Why beginning with the older ones?
They had more years to...
Yeah!
Going on.
They kind of realized the reality of what Jesus is saying first. They realize they have sin. They have, they'll say, more wisdom, right? Back then, as well as today, can you associate that as you age, you gain more wisdom? Generally, yes. Maybe it's not always true. But generally, yes, you should become more wise in the ways of the world and more understanding of human nature and more realistic about your own situation. Yeah, we should become more wise as we go through life. So the older ones, they understand what's going on here. Well, I've got sin, and you know what Jesus said? And you know, that was a good answer from him. We can't pass judgment anymore, so I'm just going to leave. So the older ones are leaving. The older ones first. They heard it. They went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And eventually Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more." So Jesus doesn't condone the sin. In fact, he tells her, "Don't do this anymore." But yet he has compassion and forgives her. Did Jesus, in a very clever way, get out of this trap set for him? Yes. And at the same time, he still had compassion upon this woman, and yet, at the same time, also said, "Stop it, don't do that." All at the same time, he accomplished all those things in this clever response that he had. Well, I expect him to have a clever response. He's Jesus, right? Yeah. All right. Couple more things. St. Augustine, commenting on this event, and now St. Augustine was 4th century, so this is just when this event here started to appear in writing. So St. Augustine in the 4th century, in commenting on this, said, "At the end of the story, there were left but two, the pitiable woman and pity." With a capital P, pity. Jesus is the source of pity upon all those who need pity. Do we all need pity? Yeah, I don't want to, you know, we don't want, you don't need to pity me. Well, yeah, Jesus does pity us to the point of dying on the cross for us. So I thought, you know, that's kind of an interesting little turn of phrase there from St. Augustine way back then. All right, now a few other things about this whole text. And I'm going to show you some pictures, so a little field trip right now. It says Jesus bent down and wrote on the ground. And what does it say? At both places it says wrote on the ground. Well, to write on the ground, that implies what is on the ground?
Dirt.
Dirt. Yeah, dirt or dust. Now, this is just a little bit of Pastor Measle piling on the idea that this is not original to the Gospel of John. Because, let me show you some pictures here. Let me see, first of all, let me go down to, here. Okay, there's a diagram. Can you see that at all? Should I turn the front lights off? There's nobody sitting up here but me and Andy anyway. There's a diagram of the temple. This was all built out of stone. Probably the floor was as well. If it were dirt, it would have gotten chewed up by all that traffic. And then let me show you a few pictures of the modern day, just to tie in with our recent trip, but also because it makes up a little bit of a point here as well. So let me see, back up here. Bear with me, sorry. It's real pretty pictures. There we go. It's real too. Okay, so first of all, here is a modern day picture of our trip. This is what would commonly have been called, as referred to as the Wailing Wall, but that's a misnomer. It's actually the Western Wall. The Jews don't call it the Wailing Wall. And actually, when we're there, there's nobody wailing. But there are all these Orthodox Jews up there praying. And they're doing their kind of nodding thing and touching, and they wrap up their prayers and stick it in the cracks. That's Dennis right there, Kern, in my picture. So this is the Western Wall, which has the only part that's still original to Herod's temple from 4 BC, the time of Jesus. This right here is original foundation from Herod's temple. And then this is a later addition on top. So that's why the Orthodox Jews revere this place so much, because it's the only place left of their original glorious temple built by the evil King Herod. Okay? All right. And then, on top, here's the top of the Temple Mount. Look at the ground. Now, the current Temple Mount was built by the Muslims in the Middle Ages, because they controlled the Temple Mount, and which irks the Jews to no end, because they say it's their temple. But during the Crusades time, the Jews were all driven out, the Christians were all driven out, the Muslims had control of it. So this dates back to the Middle Ages. That's one of the two mosques that's on the Temple Mount. So, was there stone pavement at the time of Jesus in the temple? We don't know for sure, but I for one would say probably yes. This is looking in the other direction on the Temple Mount. And there are a few spots of grass like this, and there are trees up there, which surprised people. Some in our group were surprised by that. Oh, I didn't know there was trees up there. And that's the other more famous mosque that is on the Temple Mount. There's two mosques up there. One is called El Aqsa, and this one is the Dome of the Rock. Okay? Inside that particular mosque, there is a giant rock sticking out of the ground up to some, I don't know, waist-high level. And that is thought by the Jews to be the place where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac. And that's why they built the temple here. That's why Solomon built the temple in this location. It's called Mount Moriah. The Muslims, during their era of controlling this, said that that same rock is the rock from which Muhammad ascended into heaven in the 6th century, when Muhammad supposedly ascended into heaven after writing the Quran. So this is the third holiest spot for Muslims, and it's the most holy spot for Jews, especially the Orthodox Jews. So they fight over the Temple Mount. Us Christians, we can walk around more freely because for us, we're like, this is a place of historical significance, but it's not a place of reverence or, you know, worship, like those other two groups think. Okay? But again, there's all of this pavement stone that dates back to the Middle Ages. I happen to think that probably at the time of Jesus there was pavement there as well. I've got one more that I'll show you here. There's another picture looking in the other direction. Again, all this pavement, some spots of grass and some trees up there. But if this was pavement, what would Jesus have been writing in with his finger? Maybe a little patch of dirt on top of the pavement? I don't know. To me, it's just a little suspicious. Okay? So just a little advertisement there, or a little momentary show and tell from our trip. Yeah, let me go back to the text here. So that's one thing about this. Another thing that I would kind of pile on to say that this text is probably not original to the Gospel of John. Another point that is made by some scholars is that if you take this out, chapter 7, verse 53 through 8, verse 11, it actually reads more smoothly. It seems to make sense. Let me show you, and then we'll go on to the further in chapter 8. So back in chapter 7, if we finish this down here, it says, Nicodemus, chapter verse 50, Nicodemus, who had gone to him before and who was one of them, said to them, "Does our law judge a man without first giving him a hearing and learning what he does?" They replied, "Are you from Galilee too? Search and see that no prophet arises from Galilee." And then we go to chapter 8, verse 12. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, "I am the light of the world." What had he just talked about at the end of chapter 7 prior to this interlude? If you are thirsty, come to me. I am the living water. And now he says, "I am the light of the world." See, that connects. It makes sense.
And there's nobody there after it's only him and the woman.
Yes.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So in this interlude here that seems to be stuck in, it says, he went to the Mount of Olives and then came back. Well, why would that detail be there? And then at the end of this, there's nobody left but him and the woman, and then he starts talking. Well, who's he talking to? Where did the crowds come from? So it actually does make more sense that this was not there in the original Gospel of John, because you can go from chapter 7, verse 52, to chapter 8, verse 12, and it reads more smoothly and it makes sense. Okay? However, after reading Dr. Weinrich's commentary, I am fairly well convinced, or at least placated in my mind, that that event of Jesus and the adulterous woman probably was a real event that had just been carried down through oral tradition and then eventually recorded, and the scribes didn't know what to do with it, so they stuck it in. Does that make sense? Questions? Sorry, I feel like I'm in lecture mode. I was hoping those pictures of the Temple Mount might be a little... Did any of you ever you remember growing up in the era, at least, you know, I'm dating myself a little bit, of slideshows?
Oh, yeah.
I see lots of heads nodding. I remember being kind of middle school, high school age, and my parents a couple of times went on vacations without us. There was one time they went to the Oberammergau Passion Play in Germany. It was must have been 1980, and I was a freshman in high school. And they went with a group from church, and they had a blast, and my dad took slides. He didn't take pictures, he took slides. And so we came home, and he arranged them all in one of those circular things. Remember those? And he had a slide projector, and then the family was invited over, and I had to sit through the trays of slides like three times while he showed all the pictures to different family members, you know, and by the third one there, it's the lights are out, and you click, you know, and shoot, shoot, and the thing turns, and I think he had like three trays of slides he was showing, and so by the end, I'm like nodding off, and I'm like, okay, I've seen this already, do I have to stay here? You remember those days?
I still have them.
You still have the slides?
And a projector.
Really? Well, good thing you got the projector, because if you had the slides, it wouldn't do any good without a projector, right? I came to realize that shortly thereafter, I think, it became more trendy to just print out your pictures and put them in a photo album. And the advantage to that is, if you're showing them to somebody, they can skip through them as fast or as slow as they want. If you're showing slides, everybody's going at your pace, which might be too slow for some or too fast for others, depending on your attention span, right? Why did that all come up?
You showed those slides up there.
Yeah, I was showing slides, you're right. Yeah, exactly. All right. I don't think I have any slides, but what you do, Sharon. All right. You have some too, Don?
No.
No? Got rid of them all?
Before slides.
Oh, before slides! Back in the era of drawings.
There's what talkies come
out.
Talkies came out, yeah. All right, let's go on. Another paragraph. So, picking up in chapter 8, verse 12, again, Jesus spoke to them saying, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Now, I've already mentioned this a number of places. This happens 7 times in the Gospel of John. Here's another I am statement. We would call this one a predicate I am statement, because there's 7 or 9 times, depending on how you count them, where Jesus says, I am the. I am the good shepherd. I am the door. I am the light. This one is, I am the light of the world. And then there's 7 absolute I am statements, where Jesus just says, I am. And you remember in Greek what those words are?
Ego I me.
Ego I me, exactly. Ego I me, which is very obvious in native Greek, because you don't need to say both words. The ego, which is the I am. So by saying I me, which is the am, it's like saying I am, I am. He's like emphasizing it. I am. So to a native Greek speaker, it's very clear what Jesus is saying. He's equating himself to Yahweh. I am the name of Yahweh. And in this case, he says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. What is the very first thing that God created when he created? Let there be light. Absolutely. Light, and then after that came water. So those are absolutely connections to creation, to the God of creation. Jesus is equating himself to the God of creation here. This is screaming loudly to the Jews and getting them more and more upset. I am the light of the world. That's messianic. All right. Carries a lot of weight. It was thought, because of some passages in, I think it's Isaiah chapter 9, where it talks about the suffering servant, the future Messiah, will come and will bring light to the world. Okay? So it is thought that the Messiah would enlighten everyone, open our minds and enlighten everyone. And here's Jesus saying, I am the light of the world. All right. Verse 13. So the Pharisees said to him, you are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. Now, see, again, this connects with chapter 7, because what were they questioning in chapter 7? His authority to teach. Here again, they're testing his authority. You are bearing witness about yourself. Well, the Pharisees, what does the word Pharisee mean? What is their function?
Church leader.
Yeah. Teachers of the law. God's law. Well, what are kids good at? Being little lawyers, right? You know all about that. Apparently my wife accuses me of doing that too. You said to empty the dishwasher, so I just did that. You know, well, you know, you can clear the table and reload the dishwasher too, but you didn't say that. Oh, you're just as much of a little lawyer as all the kids. You know, that type of story. You know, I tell the kids to do something and they do exactly what I tell them, rather than the bigger chore that I expect. I see lots of heads nodding. You know what I'm talking about, right? So these Pharisees, who are teachers of God's law, are getting nitpicky with Jesus. They're getting lawyerly with Jesus. You are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. In God's word, in the Pentateuch, in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, you could not bear witness on your own behalf. If you were accused of something in front of a judge, you needed a separate witness to bear witness either for you, in your favor, or against you. You were not allowed to bear witness about yourself. That kind of prevented people from lying or perjuring themselves. So right here, they're accusing Jesus of that. You can't bear witness about yourself. You're saying you're the light of the world, but you can't say that. Your testimony's not true. You need somebody else to bear witness about you. So Jesus answered, verse 14, even if I do bear witness about myself, so he's getting lawyerly back with them. He's saying, I'm not saying I am, but even if I am, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I come from or where I am going. Where he comes from, what's that a reference to? His origin. His identity. Does Jesus know his own identity? Yes. And where I am going, where is he going? We can kind of think about two things. One is to the cross, and number two, back to heaven, eventually. So that's his purpose. So he's referring here to his origin or identity and his purpose or his goal. And he's using that to say, because I know where I come from and I know what my purpose is, I do have authority to witness about myself. The way I think I was trying to come up with a, you know, I came up with a little example here trying to illustrate this. If I go over to France and tell them that the U.S. wants to sign this certain particular treaty with them, do I have any authority? No. What is my origin? Stevensville, Christ Lutheran Church. That gives me no authority. What is my purpose? Who knows? I'm over there meddling in somebody else's business. But if the U.S. government sends an ambassador over to France to negotiate and sign a treaty, is the ambassador the U.S. government? Technically, no, but he's representing the U.S. government. What is his origin? It's from the government. What is his purpose? To negotiate on behalf of the government. So he does have authority. I think that's kind of what Jesus is saying here. He comes from God, from heaven. That's his origin. That gives him authority. And he has a purpose. His purpose is to save mankind, to die for our sins, to earn us the forgiveness of sins. He knows that purpose. So his origin and his purpose give him authority, and therefore his testimony is true. And they're completely oblivious to what that is. You do not know where I come from or where I am going. Verse 15, you judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. Well, eventually Jesus will judge. If he just, you know, again, here's another little disconnect. He just was asked to be the judge of that adulterous woman. Seems a little out of place with this, what he's saying right here. I judge no one, yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. So now he's starting to give them a little more clue as to what his origin and identity is. He comes from the Father, and they know he's referring to Yahweh there. So again, they're so upset with this situation that they're just closed-minded. They can't see past what Jesus is saying here. I am the Father who sent me. So he's coming from God, he's saying. Verse 17, in your law, it is written that the testimony of two people is true. That's true. In the law of Moses, it takes the testimony of two to verify the truth of something. I find it interesting that he says, in your law. Isn't this God's law? Doesn't that mean it's also Jesus' law? But I think what he's kind of referring to there, in your misinterpretation and misunderstanding of the law, in your version of the law, which isn't completely proper and appropriate, it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. Boy, that seems like a little lawyerly way out of this, too. You can't testify about yourself, Jesus. Oh, yeah? Oh, I have two witnesses. Me and God the Father are both testifying about me. So there's two witnesses to verify the truth. Well, you know, if one of my kids said that, I'd just kind of like give them the stink eye or something. I'm like, oh, you're trying to get out of it. A little lawyerly stuff there. But Jesus is, but what Jesus is saying is true, of course. So they further badger him a little bit. They said to him, therefore, where is your Father? They're thinking earthly terms. If you are testifying about yourself and you're claiming your Father is testifying about you as well, where is your Father? Well, they know the answer, the earthly answer. Joseph is already dead. He's passed away already. So they're, again, trying to trap Jesus. Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple. But no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. So he's saying, if you would know me, you would know the Father. Because They recognized the Old Testament as the words of God the Father, and if they understood those properly, they would know it points to Jesus. Okay? So all the Old Testament points to Jesus. We recognize that as well today. Do I have time to do another paragraph? Oh, that's a long one. I'm going to say no. What do you guys think? I could do another paragraph, but it would take me another 20 minutes or more. So why don't we say that's where we can pause, and I'll make sure that's where I pause tomorrow as well. All right? So last little thought here, though, to sum it up. These words he spoke in the treasury. What's that a reference to? He spoke this in the treasury as he taught in the temple. Well, back in that picture I showed you, the treasury is a reference to the alms boxes where they would collect money for the poor. And the treasury was in the court of women. So if you remember, there's the court of Gentiles, then there's the court of women, then there was the court of men and priests where the sacrifices would take place. So there's different layers of the courts around the temple. Well, the treasury, the alms boxes were in the women's court. And so that's where Jesus was when he's teaching, which would make sense. So he's in the temple proper, but not all the way in. So where he is, both men and the women can come and hear and listen to him talk and teach. And no one arrested him. Why? Because his hour had not yet come. This is the third time now we've heard that, right? Still reminiscent of when they were trying to throw Jesus off the precipice in Nazareth. And what did he do? He just walked out from them. His time was not yet. So he knows he can just kind of avoid them, you know, with head held high and walk among them. And he knows it's not time yet. So they're not going to be bold enough yet to arrest him. All right. Yeah, Karen.
The one line, you judge according to the flesh. What else would they be judging?
Well, I think what he's referring to there is you judge according to the flesh, so the letter of the law, rather than the spirit of the law. What's the opposite of flesh? Spirit. So I judge according to the spirit of the law, which means, like what we just heard in last Sunday in church, the letter of the law is you shall not murder. Don't kill another person. The spirit of the law is you shall not murder, which means you also don't hate your brother. So Jesus is teaching the spirit of the law. They are looking at the letter of the law, or according to the flesh. What does it actually say? And so they're judging by saying, well, you can't testify about yourself. That's not allowed. And you need to have two witnesses to testify. That's what they just argued with Jesus here. And he's saying, that's not the point. The point is to establish the truth of something. And that's what I'm doing, is establishing the truth. Moses said you needed two witnesses in order to establish the truth. So they are trying to argue with him according to the letter of Moses' law. And Jesus is trying to elevate them above that.
So I judge no one. It's just saying they didn't judge by the flesh? Or is
that... I think that's saying, because remember who wrote this? John. This is John. We think this is the Apostle John. What did he say to Nicodemus? What did Jesus say to Nicodemus back in John chapter 3? That he did not come to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. We would say Jesus' first coming was not about judging the world. He did condemn sin, but he didn't judge the people. When he comes the second time on the final day, on judgment day, then yes, he will be acting as judge. But up until then, His purpose is not to judge us. His purpose is to save us. That's what he told Nicodemus in chapter 3, and I think that's what he's referring to here as well, when he says, I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, future tense, when will he judge? Judgment day. My judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. So I think that's a reference to judgment day, but not now. So, you know, there's that little corny, cheesy statement among Christians, which I think is valid. Judge the sin, but not the sinner. Right? It's a valid thought, even though it's kind of overused, perhaps. love the sinner, hate the sin. Maybe that's another way that's said. And we should do that. We need to love the person while still saying what you did was wrong or what you said was hurtful. It's like Jesus did with that adulterous woman. You condemn the sin, but not the person. That should be our attitude too. And it's very often hard to love the sinner while hating the sin, isn't it? All right, good question, Karen. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
You posed the question, what did God create first? And the answer was light. When you go to Genesis 1, it said the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So there were waters already there.
It appears that way, yes.
Yes, and then verse 3, it says, let there be light.
Yeah. So water already existed, and then God created light? I guess.
So, you always hear about evolution where the world is millions of years old.
Oh, yeah.
Billions.
Billions, yeah, right.
I don't want to misquote.
Oh, it changes depending on which evolutionist you're talking to.
But is there a possibility that God created the universe billions of years ago, and that at some point in time, through this chaos, he created the earth and the way we know the earth, and since then it's been 6,000 years?
Yeah, that is a very common thought among some creationists who are trying to square the Bible with evolution. There's a problem with that. Evolution would say that death has existed from the very beginning of the billions of years. But the Bible would say death didn't exist until after Adam and Eve sinned. So after creation was over. So some would say, well, what if God created and then millions of years passed and then maybe it was way down here in time that he created Adam and Eve, or maybe he created Adam and Eve up here and they lived for quite a long time before they sinned. Except evolution says there's fossil record all the way back here and fossils require death. And so that would contradict the idea that death did not exist, which we would say as Christians according to the Bible. Death did not exist until after sin occurred. So there's the disconnect.
Well, that's if you believe that creatures were created at that time too.
Mm-hmm.
But if just the planets and the stars and that were created, but there was no life form.
So in other words, there was millions of years between day one and day two of creation.
Well, day one would be when the earth, when God
came, yep,
and rearranged creation.
Yeah. Day two, let there be light. Day two is let the waters be separated, the sky above and the land below, and land and plants. And then day three was land. Yeah, day three was land. Day two was the sea and the sky. So I suppose you could try to make the case that between day two and day three there were millions of years that existed between them. However, again, there's another disconnect there, because God says in the Bible, and there was evening, and there was morning, the third day, the second day, the first day. That is Hebrew language pointing to a day, not millions of years. So according to the Hebrew text, we would say, God is saying he created in six literal 24-hour days, without millions of years in between each day.
You know, that verse 5 says, there was evening and then there was morning the first day.
Yeah. So that right there is a grammatical clue that there was not millions of years in between. And I would say the other argument is, if there were millions of years in between, evolutionists would say that would necessitate death because there's fossils in there. And we would say, well, that death didn't occur until after creation was over. So I don't think that it's a very strong argument that we would argue that there were millions of days embedded within the days of creation.
Well, and then the science doesn't disproves it also, because it's like the fossils, I think it was in 2005, they found like blood cells in fossils. Well, fossil blood cells can't live for millions and millions of years. It's impossible.
Right.
So there's no way they can be millions of years old, even though they say they are.
Yeah, what you're talking about
is
there was
coming up with
soft tissue found in fossil matter.
Right.
And that can't exist for more than a few thousand years.
Right.
Otherwise it would just disintegrate. So that disproves the idea of fossils being millions of years old. Yeah.
Right.
There's a lot of issues. And so, yeah, we could talk about a lot more topics. I've read a fair amount on creation and evolution, so.
Fossils almost prove that the Christian theory is correct. Not theory, but the Christian story is correct.
Yeah.
Because to me, in order to create a fossil, there has to be a rabbit cover of this.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly right. Fossils are not created slowly over time. They're created rapidly by being buried in mud. Well, when did that happen? Noah's flood. Right. Not a little at a time. Well, something is stuck in the mud and then, you know, years and years and it gets more and more covered. No, that can't happen. That's not how fossils are made. You're exactly right. Yeah.
That's how they find seashells in the mountains too.
Yeah. All right. Well, good discussion. So we'll pick up again next week with verse 21 of chapter 8. Let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good evening, and happy Valentine's Day.